Yeah.
Which was pretty amazing.
Uh-huh.
Great.
Well, there is certainly a lot to write about that place. My mother is from Israel, but that's another story. She grew up in a kibbutz. Okay, so we'll get started.
Okay.
I'm in Richard Jewish Michelson's office, and we're doing an oral history interview for the Jewish Historical Society of Western Massachusetts, our series of interviews on Jewish writers of Western Mass. So first thing I would ask you to do is just maybe give a kind of a brief overview or biography of yourself as a writer.
Mm-hmm. So is this the sort of thing like that you're going to edit, or
no,
do
this
I need
is just
to speak in full sentences?
You can speak as you wish, however you wish. It will. My intention is to just have it go up on our website for, you know, for people later on, 10 years from now, 10 mm-hmm. minutes from now, 100 years from now, who want to know what's okay. Jewish life in Western Massachusetts.
Yeah, just about. So that so, I know as far yeah. as. So what everything I say is on the record.
Right. Yeah. and it's right. There's no current intention of right. publishing it, except to just put it up on this website that the group has.
So, so just about my writing career.
Yeah, your writing career. You know, just the overall arc of your writing mm-hmm. career.
And, well, I moved to. Well, I grew up in East New York, Brooklyn, actually. Because you and I just almost had lunch, and we mentioned the poet Martina Spada in the same neighborhood. Martina and I grew up in the same neighborhood. We didn't know each other then, of course. It was I'm not in Western Mass yet. It was a Jewish neighborhood, and then became a Black neighborhood, and then a Latino neighborhood. We were the one Jewish family who did not leave the neighborhood, not for any high-minded ideals, but for financial reasons. So I grew up primarily, surrounded by Blacks and Latinos. And a lot of my later books, of course, are about race and social justice issues. Martine grew up in the same neighborhood. Okay, we would later meet here in Western Massachusetts, where I followed him as Poet Laureate of Northampton. Mm-hmm. So you would never know that two young East New York folks, but the way we look at it, you either grew up in that neighborhood, you learned to fight, or you learned to write. So one or the other. I came here in 1979. At the time, I don't think I had any books out. I believe I had published my first chapbook called The Head of the Family. So that probably came out in the mid-70s, but basically when I moved to this area, I was not a writer, or I was an unknown writer, I shall say. Then I opened an art gallery. I did meet, when I came here, the first artist whose work I took on was a young prep school teacher by the name of Barry Mosier. And Barry Mosier's closest friend was a poet by the name of Paul Mariani. So Paul would have been one of the first poets I met from this area. He and I, as it happens, I have a new book coming out, a new poetry book coming out next month, which I mentioned to you, called Sleeping as Fast as I Can. And it is by the same publisher as Paul Mariani. So I will be having a reading at this gallery where Martine will introduce both myself and Paul. So long history with these folks. I did continue to write poetry, of course. But I didn't really publish much because I was starting my gallery and I was busy trying to make something of that. I had spent 3 years before opening my gallery, basically selling out of the back of my van and traveling around the country. When I moved here, I opened a little gallery at Barry Ann. Was working all the time, would write a little bit when I could, here and there. It wasn't until my first full book of poetry called Tap Dancing for the Relatives. When would that have come out? I even have a copy here. I'll have to check. But it was... So that would have come out after I was here, actually, because I have a Barry Mosher engraving on the cover, which I see here. So my first book of poetry would have been published in 1985, right? So a few years after I was here. And
if you know, I just break in and quickly ask you, what drew you? You said you moved to the area in 1979. What drew you here?
So I had never been here before. I knew nothing about the area. I was basically selling. I'm from Brooklyn, as I mentioned. I grew up because my neighborhood was a poor neighborhood. And I grew up with my dad putting the mantra in my head, work hard. One of these days you're going to get out of this neighborhood. Just work hard. You'll get out of it. Mm-hmm. Now I could barely afford to get back in. But at the time, I wanted to escape Brooklyn. I barely knew Manhattan existed because, you know, we were too poor. I didn't really go in. I wanted to earn some money to go to college. As it happened, I got a job as a traveling salesman selling art reproductions around the country at the beginning of semesters. Where did you go to college?
I went to college in Oregon, Reed College. Okay. Yeah.
So a lot of people will remember that that when they would come in to college, there were people selling art reproductions.
Sure, yeah.
So that was my business. I had never been in a museum or a gallery before, but I got a job selling art reproductions in order to sell art
around
reproductions
campuses
around campuses and things like that. I thought that I could sell more. Three for five. That was my pitch for posters. So I would started to go into museums where the original pieces of the posters I had were, and I was basically struck dumb by it. I just fell in love with it, and I couldn't believe things like this existed. And I decided after 3 years of being on the road that what I wanted to do was, instead of selling reproductions of famous artists, I wanted to find my own artists and make them famous. I started doing some writing while I was on the road. I was not a good student in school, but I did start doing that. And after 3 years, I decided that I would quit. But of course, I didn't have money to start my own gallery. So I made a bet with my boss, who we used to play ping pong together.
And this was the guy who was running the show.
This was the guy who was running the art reproduction show. We decided to play a game of ping pong. And if he won, I said I would work for him for another 3 years. And if I won, he promised he would set me up in business.
That's high stakes.
And they were high stakes. and I won. And true to his word, he signed over the van that I was driving to me, and I opened a little gallery in Illinois near the University Urbana, mm-hmm. Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. And because I was used to going to colleges and selling reproductions, he paid for the first year's rent and staked me mm-hmm. to get started, mm-hmm. which I did out there. My wife at the time, who I would fly in to see me on weekends at whatever college I was at, uh-huh. Was living in New York. And I flew her out and to Champaign-Urbana, where I had just signed a lease for a year to open my own gallery. And she basically got off the plane and said, if you think I'm living out here, you got another thing coming. although she did end up going to transferring to the college there for a year, and then moved back to New York. I did not want to move back to New York because I had spent my whole life trying to get out of New York, mm-hmm. But I knew college towns and I wanted to open a business, mm-hmm. and so my wife scouted out some places that were college towns, mm-hmm. this being one of them, Princeton being another one. She ended up renting a little place here in Amherst, sending me the address, and then I loaded my van and came east, and on my way I was reading a poetry chapbook that happened to be illustrated by a young artist by the name of Barry Mosier, and so I stopped at a phone booth and called Barry and said I wanted to open a gallery. And he invited me over, and he was my first artist, and that is how I met Paul Mariani and started to meet other artists uh-huh. And writers in the area. My book, Tap the Ends and Meet Relatives, came out in 1985, which happened to be the same year that Barry came to me and said, he was offered a job to illustrate a children's book, and what did I think about that? And I said, Barry, that's the worst fucking idea I ever heard in my life. We were trying hard to make a serious gallery. I did not grow up reading books, reading children's books. They were far from my idea of anything I knew.
Yeah.
Any books that I did know would have been kind of the ones you picked up at supermarkets, you know, kind of Disney stuff. But Barry went ahead. In fact, I said to him, so what are you going to start doing, a little watercolor bunnies now? And it turns out his first book was the Tales of, was Br'er Rabbit, and he did watercolor bunnies. At the time, I only had maybe five or six artists. Now we have over 200.
Yeah.
So when it came time for Barry to have his annual show, I put up those little watercolor bunnies. And again, in order to learn more about it, I started reading children's books. And I discovered there was a whole world out mm-hmm. there that I knew nothing about. I loved art, obviously. And I loved poetry. And suddenly I saw, well, there are people like Maurice Sendak, there are people like Eric Carle, there are people like Jane Yolen, mm-hmm. who you'll be interviewing. There were people who were doing picture books. And I thought that the art in them were as good as some of the best art I was seeing on museum walls. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the writing in some of them were poetry. Real poetry. Mm-hmm. And I started to get interested in picture books. Didn't start writing them because I was still writing my adult work. After Tap Dancing came out, I continued to write poetry, but I wasn't sending it out because I was too busy building my gallery and working, and I needed the money. I did go back to school because I went to the Goddard MFA program. Because it was non-residency. And I was reading a lot of poetry, but I felt that there was gaps in my education because I hadn't studied much. Yet I couldn't go to a residency because I was working. So that seemed to be a perfect place I could go for non-residencies. And so I did, and I was writing and writing. Again, not sending it out. It wasn't until much later that my next book came out. My next adult book came out in, 2006. So I started the children's books then before that. So my first children's book came out, I believe, in 1993. And it was because at that time I was hanging out with a lot of children's book writers and illustrators. Mm-hmm. But more than that, I still wasn't trying my hand on that because I was writing the poems that would later become my second book. But I was out, my son was young at the time, and he was scared of ghosts, and I used to tease him a bit before he went to bed, and he was scared of ghosts, and I would say, "Don't worry, there's no such thing as ghosts, blah blah blah," and then I would tiptoe out of the room and I'd open the door and say, "Besides, if there were ghosts, the witches would scare them away," and then I'd close the door and I'd have to go back in and say, "Don't worry, there's no witches." I was having lunch with a friend of mine, telling him how I had tortured my poor boy the night before, kept him up scared. And my friend happened to be Jeff Dwyer, who lived in Northampton, does now, and was a agent for children's books. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, "Write that down, and I'll sell it, and we'll get Leonard Baskin to illustrate it." And I did, and that was the genesis of my very first children's book called Did You Say Ghosts? With Leonard Baskin.
And did you dedicate that book to your son?
Did I dedicate that book? I hope I did.
What's your son's connection to, how does your son feel about that book?
Well, what I learned, of course, is that it takes quite some time for books to come out.
So by the time it came out.
By the time it came out, my son was didn't want me to go around to the school saying he was scared of ghosts, etc. But most people don't realize that, you often wait 3 or 4 years after you write a book till you see it in print. Also, what happened with that book, because I was a poet, and my first book had taken about 5 years to sell 300 copies, because that's what poetry is in this country. And probably 200 of those copies were probably bought by friends of mine, and that's about it.
I can relate.
All of a sudden I was told that that our book had over 10,000 pre-orders. And I said, "Wow, this is a nice gig, children's books." I couldn't sell 10,000 copies of a poetry book, no matter what happened. You have to be Billy Collins or Robert Frost. That's your choice. So I thought, this is going to be a good gig. And then I got for my first children's book, I got a notice in The New Yorker. The New Yorker, who had never once published one of my poems, and I always wanted to be in The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And my first book, of course, was written as a poem, mm-hmm. Just broken up. Suddenly, the New Yorker excerpted my book. Mm-hmm. I was a New Yorker poet through my children's book.
Yeah.
And they called it one of their 10 best children's books of the year. Uh-huh. It hadn't been out yet, but this is why I had a lot of pre-sales. And then Macmillan Publishing Company declared bankruptcy before my book came out. And it was a Halloween title, of course. Uh-huh. And Macmillan and all these 10,000 pre-orders were suddenly in limbo. Macmillan was bought out by Simon & Schuster. They were consolidating the warehouses. This is a real ghost horror story. Mm-hmm. And decided not to, they would not be shipping Macmillan books for a couple of months. Mm-hmm. So, they did not ship my Halloween book until November. And all those bookstores who had ordered it sent them back or canceled their orders. And that's how business works. And because my first book now had a bad, if you go into the computers and it's all, you know, by sales, not only did I not have my 10,000 sales, but somehow 11,000 copies were returned. And so Macmillan, which had agreed to take my next few books, suddenly,
before they'd even issued this one, they already had
the next one in line, but they were no longer there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you go on the computer and it looks like, well, I'm no longer a bestseller. Very few books made it out there. So it took a few years till I sold my next children's book, which was also with Leonard Baskin, called Animals That Ought to Be. And that sold very well, but it got a bad review in the New York Times Book Review. Still, it got a review in the New York Times Book Review.
Yeah.
Right? So, so far I had two children's books. One in New Yorker. One had been reviewed in the New York Times. I decided that this was something I loved doing. Leonard and I would later do two other books of poetry together. But then most people, however, know me for my Jewish-themed children's books. That is really, I think, in that world.
So the first two, the ghost one obviously wasn't, and then this next
they
one
were
wasn't.
Poetry, right, fun yeah, books, right, yeah. The two later books I did with Leonard Baskin, although he's a Jewish artist, were also, one was a kind of funny math book, and one was a funny science book.
Yeah. So how did you? What was the jump into the Jewish?
The jump into the Jewish was that my children were studying for their bar and bat mitzvah. Mm-hmm. I want to take a quick side view here to say that I grew up with no Jewish education whatsoever.
Me too.
Okay, my mother refused to step into a temple or synagogue. I was not bar mitzvahed. I am a product of the generation that wanted to turn away from everything Jewish. Later, when I started becoming known as a Jewish writer and getting invited to speak in synagogues all across the country, because the first thing my mother would think is, where did I go wrong? but I did not grow up that way. My wife, who I mentioned earlier, grew up Methodist. And she, however, was religious. I was not. I refused to be married by a rabbi or anybody or, you know, a priest or anything. So we had a civil ceremony. Mm-hmm. And however, after we got married, my wife, against my wishes, frankly, decided she wanted to convert to Judaism. And she studied here in Western Massachusetts mm-hmm. with Yahya Lander, mm-hmm. Who was a wonderful rabbi and also a wonderful, intelligent man, and by happenstance was a very close friend of Leonard Baskin, mm-hmm. who I represented, so I got to know him fairly well. Mm-hmm. Jennifer was bringing home books and asking me questions, and I would say, how the hell do I know? but I started reading some of the books she brought home. Mm-hmm. Isaac Bashevis Singer books, some history books. The other thing was that Jennifer was studying in a class, as it were, not an official class, with one other student. And that student happened to be Julius Lester. For those All people right, who
I've
don't
read,
know,
I read about his
Julius's book on his own conversion.
Love Song, right?
Love yeah. Song yeah. is one of the best books on identity, Jewish or otherwise, I have ever read. I encourage everyone to read it. Jennifer had to go to some services as part of her conversion thing. She dragged me, kicking and yelling, to one. And I walked in, and there in the front row with her davening was a black man. And I knew Julius only as a black militant, which he had been previously.
Right.
In his life. Also, somebody who had a radio show in New York City that was kicked off for anti-Semitic reading. Mm-hmm. And Julius became a very dear friend of mine. And all of a sudden, here was Yahya Lander, a man whose intellect I very much respected. Mm-hmm. And Julius Lester, another man whose intellect I respected. So I said, let me look into some of this. And I started reading the Jewish poets, the Yiddish poets in translation. I started reading much of Jewish literature and found myself very much taken with it.
Can you speak to, so you mentioned Singer. Can you speak to some of the, you know, some of these Yiddish poets or any Jewish writers, Jewish texts that... It really had a profound impact.
Obviously, Singer was a nice entreeway into it, and uh-huh. of course, the contemporary people, Philip Roth, etc. You know, the poets, Jacob Gladstein was one whose mm-hmm. I started reading. The other name went out of my, who just went out of my mind. He was also a partisan in. I'll come back to it.
Yeah, sure.
I'll come back to it. And then what happened to jump back to the original train is my children started studying for their bar and bar mitzvah. Mm-hmm. At this point, I had just started writing picture books, but poetry. And one of the assignments was to learn more about where their... where people to interview family members mm-hmm. about basically what you're doing now mm-hmm. interview yeah. family members about their history
yeah.
where they came from around this same time also the National Yiddish Book Center was opening mm-hmm. okay and I knew Aaron Lansky as a friend as a writer all these things happened at the same time here in Western yeah. Mass so I realized that my children, when they started interviewing me, I realized that I was a smart guy, but I knew almost nothing about my own family's history. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know where my grandparents had grown up, where they mm-hmm. came from, any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I had no relationship with my grandparents, frankly. My father's parents you know, died before I had any interest, while I was still being a young American boy and I had no interest in it. My mom's mother died early when my mother was young. My mom's father was very, very religious, but that's who my mom was rebelling against, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, so none of that happened. So I decided that I needed to learn about where I came from so that my children did not grow up in the same ignorance that I did. And I'm a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want to learn something, I learn it by sitting down and writing about it. And that's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, I wanted to make this palatable to my children because they were young and they wanted to know. So I started writing some stories, one of which is Grandpa's Gamble, which was illustrated by Barry Mosher, which was another one is Too Young for Yiddish, which was illustrated by Neil Waldman. And I started learning that, for instance, my religious grandfather, who I thought was the most boring man in the world because he prayed all day, every day, you know, the three times and then more and this and that. And, you know, he had no life as far as I could tell that was not sitting and praying. I found out some very interesting things, which became part of the book I wrote, was that he was a gambler. And my mother's oldest sister was very ill. He was a gambler when he came to this country. He needed to figure out a way to make some money. He did some, you know. His oldest daughter was ill, who was maybe 20-something years older than my mother. He thought he was being punished by God for having left the old country and turned away from its ways. And so he made a bet with God, you know, make my daughter well, and I will devote my life to you.
Wait, now this sounds so familiar to me because a couple of reasons. There's the...
maybe you read my book. I don't know.
Well, no, I didn't. I'd like to. But no, who's the Jewish graphic novelist? Will Eisner.
Will Eisner?
Yeah.
Is this someone?
Contract with God.
Oh, okay. I haven't read that.
You've got to check that out.
I
so this
read
is
it.
A... Contract with God is a they call it a graphic novel.
Right.
It's actually several stories. But the Contract with God story is about a man who, he adopts a little girl. And then they become very, very close, and then she dies. And he is furious because he had made a contract with God. So there's a similarity.
I will look that up.
And then, well, yeah, anyway, right. I don't want to interrupt you.
So that became my children's book, Grandpa's Gamble, which was really my first Jewish-themed book, I think. You know, and it didn't do particularly well, but it got very well reviewed. As far as that goes, and when it came out, what was interesting was I sent it to my mom, and she said, "Oh, so did you make up this story?" And I said, "No, I didn't make up this story. This is your family story." And my mother said, "No, it's not. My father was not a gambler, and this is not anything that ever happened." I said, "Well, I thought you told me this." I mean, I didn't make it up. How could it have happened, you know? My mother asked her eldest sister at the time, who said that, yes, this was the story. And my mother said she had never heard this story.
Huh.
And my aunt said, "Well, that's because she had never told anyone this story." So where did I hear the story?
Huh.
I still don't know.
Huh.
It's a mystery to me.
Wow.
I must have heard it somehow, somewhere. I just assumed. But it was a story that my aunt thought that she had kept to herself.
Yeah.
She was older than all the other kids.
Huh.
And she grew up, of course, in a very different situation. The other kids all grew up with a religious father. So that was interesting to me. Made me very interested. Then I wrote another story called Too Young for Yiddish, as I said, which is about a boy, me, who grew up knowing nothing about their grandparents' life and wanted to learn it. And their grandfather, in this case, their wants them to be all American and not bar themselves with, with the old country, as it were. The wonderful thing about being a writer is you can give yourself relationships with people that you don't have in real life. In the book, my grandfather and I had a wonderful relationship as he taught me Yiddish, which I do not speak, I'm sorry to say. And I learned everything about his life. Mm-hmm. And when I went on book tour with that book, I found that we were selling more to older Jewish people than we were to young kids. Uh-huh. They were all buying it for their kids. Uh-huh. And they would all come up to me after my readings and start speaking to me in Yiddish, which means that I did a good job convincing them I could speak Yiddish. The lucky thing, of course, is that I didn't have to, when you get some of these old Jews talking Yiddish,
They'll find each other.
They don't shut up. You nod every now and again and you go, oy vey, oh yeah, and that's fine. So then what happened? So then I started writing. I'm trying to remember. I'm sure I'm not doing this in order. I wrote another book about Martin Luther King. It'll go quicker now. And Abraham Joshua Heschel.
Oh yeah, I was going to ask about that.
And why did I write that? I came to that because I wrote a book Across the Alley first, which was a book about a Jewish kid and a black kid who, and now of course, that was the terminology I grew up with. Now of course we know there are many black Jews, but I'm still, in that book, there was a Jewish kid and a black kid, a Jewish neighborhood that was changing and becoming all black, my story, which I was telling now so my kids would learn about me. And at one point in the middle, it was 50-50. The blacks weren't allowed to play with the Jews. The Jews weren't allowed to play with the blacks. But my window, or Abe in the book, faced Willie's window, Ian's window, Willie in the book. And they become best friends at night.
So this was reflecting your actual...
This was reflecting my life.
You had a neighbor named Ian.
So I wrote that book where the two of them overcome the neighborhood's prejudice, even though, again, in real life, we didn't. In real life, he would pick on me when his friends were around, and I'd been picking him when my friends were around. But we were friends in real life. Again, you can give yourself a different outcome. Mm-hmm. You can make yourself stronger and braver. And then I started thinking about why I was not a coward. I knew what I was doing was wrong. Why was I always scared to stand up for what I knew was right? And I started thinking about people who had the courage of their convictions. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, Abraham Joshua Heschel came into my mind because that's somebody who is now revered, who I had studied when my wife was studying, mm-hmm. Who really was trashed, as it were, when he first spoke out against the Vietnam War or marched with Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. Jews have enough problems, why are you helping them? Now we revere him many ways, but at the time, he was not revered. Mm-hmm. Most rabbis and most turned against him. Mm-hmm. So I started, and then I learned about, I first became known with Heschel, not because of his Judaism, but because I was about to be drafted to the Vietnam War. I was planning my escape route to Canada, as it were. I've read both Heschel and King's speeches mm-hmm. against the war. I was trying to shore up my intellectual mm-hmm. arguments. And then I decided to write a book about their marching together. And I did. And at this point, totally unplanned, I was starting to be labeled as a Jewish writer. And then a company, Sleeping Bear Press, who does children's books and does a lot of children's books of had a series, an alphabet book series, and they were planned. They had a African American alphabet, or, you know, every kind of thing, and they were planning a Jewish alphabet. And they reached out to my agent and asked if I wanted to do it. It kind of struck me as weird. I still didn't think at that point of myself as a Jewish mm-hmm. writer. I was writing about myself mm-hmm. and my family. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Jewish writer, that was not what I was. And at first, I turned them down because what did I know about the ins and outs of Judaism? I really don't know the details of it. I didn't grow up with it. It was not in my thing. At the time, I had become good friends with Leonard Nimoy, who I would later write a book about. And Leonard was very Jewish. And when I told him I had turned down this book, he said, "Rich, the jobs I take are the ones that scare me." And I realized that, you know, I was maybe the perfect person to write this book, because if you grow up steeped in it, it's like a fish in the ocean, you know. But I was standing on dry land. I, in fact, had a lot of the same questions kids would have, because I didn't know anything about it. So I called back, and I took that job, mm-hmm. Decided that this was my chance to really start learning about Judaism outside of me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I did.
Yeah, which is what you said before about if you need to learn something, you write about it.
I write about it. Yeah. And you know, and all of a sudden, I was writing a book that was supposed to be going to be used in Jewish day schools around the country to mm-hmm. teach kids what they need to know about Judaism. Mm-hmm. Seems odd, right? These paths that we're on—it's crazy. So I had 26 letters to work with. What are the 26 most important things to learn about Judaism? I had charts, I had things, mm-hmm. I narrowed down, I put end bars explaining things, little poems. It was quite a task. But for me, it turned out to be a wonderful task. And then I ended up writing, you know, books about other Jews. Some of whom's name I came across when I was doing my research mm-hmm. that didn't end up in that book. Yeah. Lippman Pike, the very first Jewish baseball player, who was written out of the history books, because when Spalding was starting a sporting goods company and decided to pretend that baseball was an all-American sport, and they made up this whole Cooperstown thing, it turns out that they didn't want a Jew who was the very first baseball superstar, did not fit their look of an All-American sport.
So you say make up the Cooperstown, like just the whole legend of
the whole legend.
Baseball.
Doesn't exist. Not so.
Right, okay. Right.
It goes way back before the Civil War, came over from England. I mean, I could write you a whole thing on that. But Lippman Pike was the very first ever professional baseball player. He's the reason that baseball became a professional sport. He was also the home run king. He was the first superstar.
And what years are these?
1870s.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And he was written out of the history because Spalding was making it an all-American mm-hmm. game. Yeah. I've spoken at Cooperstown mm-hmm. since and mm-hmm. spent my hour there complaining to them that he's not in the Hall of Fame. And then I decided to write a children's book about Leonard Nimoy because I was writing books about famous Jewish Americans, and Leonard was my one of my closest friends. Mm-hmm. And we used to travel together all the time and tell each other about our histories and backgrounds. And he had a fascinating history. And of course, you know, the live long and prosper hand thing, mm-hmm. is an old Jewish, right. symbol, which he first saw when he was 8 years old in Temple. So I wrote that book. And then I started getting more and more, I started getting better known for my children's books. Another quick detour is I was writing poetry for adults in all this time, but I wasn't sending it out. Because suddenly I had a career as a children's book writer, and my books did very well. They were winning awards. I did win a National Jewish Book Award for a later book I did on Eliezer Ben Yehuda, and the beginning of and his The Reinvention of Hebrew. Mm-hmm. That came about because I was on tour with Neil Waldman, who illustrated my book on Yiddish. And Neil told me the story of Eliezer Ben Yehuda and said he had been planning to write a children's book about, mm-hmm. it, but wasn't able to, and he gave it to me as a gift. So that came about. And then I got a letter from an editor at the University of Illinois Press, who was the head of the University of Illinois poetry series. He told me he had been reading my children's books to his grandchildren, Larry Lieberman. And he happened to have on his bookshelf a very old book called Tap Dancing for the Relatives, that I had written, 20-something years before. Yeah. And he was curious whether I was the same person, because obviously of the 300 so copies that sold, he bought one of them, right? So again, we're going back to 1985, and I said I was, and he asked if I were still writing poetry, and I said I was, and he said, but that I wasn't publishing it, and he said he would like to see it, and hence my second book of poetry came out, Battles and Lullabies, much, 20 years after my first book. And I continued to write the kids' books, the Jewish kids' books. I was now very well steeped into it. And then Northampton asked me if I would be willing to be poet laureate of Northampton. And again,
what does that entail exactly? What are your job duties?
It doesn't entail anything. Uh-huh. It is an official title that is, that it comes with no money and no stipend and no duties, but the hope is that you will help spread the word of poetry. Mm-hmm. Again, at first I said no, because I only had two books out, but I was writing a lot of the kids' books. And obviously, at this point, I was fairly well known in the community. Mm-hmm. But then again, I thought, well, you know what? This is a chance for me to get back to writing my adult poetry. Mm-hmm. And so I said I would do it. It's a 2-year term. And I gave myself those 2 years to publish another adult book, mm-hmm. of poetry, which I did. Which is More Money Than God. At this point, that poetry book was more and more Jewish, because, of course, I'm writing about my life, and this is my life, mm-hmm. now. It was supposed to come out with the University of Illinois, which had already given me a contract for it. But then the University of Illinois dropped their poetry program, So I was back at square one.
Mm-hmm.
I was very fortunate in that what I thought was the best poetry publisher in the country at the time, University of Pittsburgh, I sent it to them, and mm-hmm. they took it. Mm-hmm. So suddenly I was a poet laureate with another book out that did very well in poetry. I kept writing my kids' books, and that brings us to today.
Mm-hmm.
My next adult poetry book comes out April 18th on Yom HaShoah Day, it is called Sleeping as Fast as I Can. It is certainly my most Jewish book, if I can say so. It's being published by Slant Book Publishers, which is...
Is that a local...
No, they're wonderful national press that is primarily known for their... they started with the mantra that when you think of great art of the past, most of what we think of as the great art of the past, Michelangelo, Da Vinci, the great poets of mm-hmm. the past, Dante, most of those poets are all, and painters are all religious poets and painters.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the history of art and the history of poetry. Milton, all the great mm-hmm. writers, were basically religious poets.
Mm-hmm.
And what Slant Book said was, in this day and age, when you think of great poetry and great art, we tend to think of schlock. Velvet Jesuses,
mm-hmm.
light verse, mm-hmm. Nothing that's really delving in the way that the great artists of the past did into...
Right, because they were really exploring difficult questions.
Right. And it seems to have codified into, into not. So what Slant Books, what they wanted to do was to find the poets today who are wrestling with religious traditions.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah.
And they reached out.
Yeah.
And I felt that that was a good home for me at this
mm-hmm.
point.
Yeah.
My new book has a whole section on my own reinterpretation of the Haggadah in poetry.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a lot of Jewish historical poems about pandemics of the past,
mm-hmm.
where Jews were often blamed
right.
for the pandemics of the past. The blood libels, that sort of thing. Oftentimes, when in the Middle Ages, when there were pandemics, the Jews were considered...
pogroms right afterwards.
They were slaughtered afterwards.
Yeah.
They were thought of to bringing them on. And often it was because they suffered worse for them. Why did they suffer worse for them? Because they tended to be in walled-off communities, not interacting with the mm-hmm. public at large. So these things came to them later, if at all. Also, because of Passover, which we're coming up to, they had to clean out their houses, and they had to clean out their grain bins, etc., which is where a lot of this pandemics begin.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my latest book that's coming out, and I have four or five children's books in the hopper. My next one is a biography of Sidney Taylor, who wrote The All of a Kind Family, which were the first Jewish children's books mm-hmm. to reach a wide audience. And that came about because I'm happy to say that I have twice, I'll brag, it's the end now, we're at the end. I have twice won the Sidney Taylor Gold Medal from the Association of Jewish Libraries for the best Jewish children's book of the year. And on my second win, I met Sidney Taylor's daughter. And I realized I hadn't read Sidney Taylor. And I didn't really know anything about her, and she's fascinating. Who, you know, who brought Jewish children's books into mainstream. So I wrote a book on her. I have a book coming out on the first Jewish Supreme Court Justice, Louis Brandeis. And God, could we use him now? What a brilliant and far-thinking man. I have a couple of Passover books coming out, one about the very first Passover in history in the White House, which was held by President Obama.
I remember, 2009.
Yes, and I'm writing about the history of that, and I will get to meet Obama, so I'm kind of excited about that. He promised to help publicize it. What else is coming out? I have a book coming out on Maimonides, and these are all children's books, and another book coming out on another Passover book coming out about my family in the future, Jewish basketball, lots of things. So I'm busy, and it all comes down to having moved here to Western Massachusetts and meeting these people who really my entree into Judaism, Yachiel Landa, Julius Lester, Leonard Nimoy, people who held my hand and taught me, my wife, of course, and the fact that I have been embraced by Jewish librarians everywhere. The PJ Library, I would be amiss if I didn't mention them. Howard Grinspoon, who brought me to Israel, and the PJ Library, which does many, many Jewish books, puts them into the hands of Jewish kids all over the country, and has often bought 20, 30,000 copies of my books to give them away. And what a pleasure that is. So that when I do speak now in synagogues or in things, I'm constantly met by Jewish parents who know my books and have read my books. And this is my community now. The end.
Beautiful. And you become such a learned person as a result of
who would have thunk it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. So, I mean, yeah, I had questions, but you've answered them all.
Yeah, well, I talk for a living.
No, this is great. Thank you. Thanks so much. So